Good afternoon. I'm opening up an informational meeting of the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources, January 22nd, and I think we will have hopefully a couple more members joining us soon. As I mentioned, the majority of the committee was actually at State Penitentiary, and we were fortunate that they let us out to come here for the hearing, so we're pleased to be here. First, we're going to hear from the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and we're pleased to have the director, Richard Whitman, and staff, Bob Grundy, with us today. Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, Richard Whitman, the director of the Oregon Department of Land Conservation and Development. I do have with me here Bob Grundy, who's a policy analyst in the director's office as well, to help with this presentation. Chair Dingfelder, we are going to try to cover at least two issues in this informational briefing, and those are the current status of the Destination Resort Program in the state of Oregon, and then we're going to try to give you a quick overview of some of the recommendations coming out of the Big Look Task Force in terms of a 30-year review of Oregon's land use system. To the extent we have time, we may also try to give you just a brief overview of some of the other governor's bills relating to land use that are out there that we're working on as well. So that's what we'd like to try to do this afternoon. That sounds okay to you. We'll proceed with the presentation.
Thank you.
Okay, could I have the PowerPoint, please? Okay. So first, to give you just a status report on where we are as a state with the Destination Resort Program in Oregon. Okay. Destination resorts first started in the state of Oregon back in the 1960s and 70s, and really started before we had a state land use program. So when everyone thinks about destination resorts, they often think about the sort of iconic destination resorts of Salishan, Black Butte Ranch, Sun River. But it's important to remember that those are not actually resorts that were sited under Oregon's land use planning program. They are sort of were some of the conceptual basis for the Destination Resort Program. As you all know, starting in the 1970s, we had the origins of Oregon's statewide land use program with Senate Bill 100, and then the adoption of the statewide planning goals in 1975. Those laws, Senate Bill 100, Senate Bill 101, and the statewide planning goals, among other things, do limit development in rural areas of the state, in particular on agricultural lands and forest lands. As a result of those limitations, any sort of large-scale residential development or resort-oriented development on rural lands in the state was no longer allowed under those goals, under those statutes, without going through a process to take an exception to those goals. So during that time, we did have several proposed resorts in both the Hood River Valley and also on the Oregon coast. So in the early 1980s, the legislature convened a task force to look at our Oregon land use program. It's really a predecessor to our current Big Look task force, and that's the Stafford-Hansel task force. And among the recommendations coming out of that task force were recommendations relating to destination resorts. And part of what they noted was using the exceptions process, sort of a, for those of you familiar with local land use, a variance process to decide where destination resorts would be allowed, really means you're approaching it on a case-by-case basis. Very time-consuming, a lot of litigation, not a whole lot of upfront thought and planning about where such uses make the most sense and exactly what form those uses should take. So there was a recommendation coming out of the Hansel Task Force for the state land use program to pay attention to destination resorts and provide for them expressly. That led to a second effort by the Land Conservation and Development Commission and then the then Economic Development Commission, a subcommittee working on destination resorts specifically. And this laid the foundation for what is now Statewide Planning Goal 8. The basic concepts were, first of all, to define what is the use that we want to allow and to some extent promote out there in rural areas of the state. So main elements of that are visitor-oriented accommodations, developed recreational facilities, and in a location that has an outstanding natural setting. The main objectives were to attract visitors into regions of our state that will benefit from those visits in terms of tourist dollar expenditures, in terms of additional tax revenue into the economies of those parts of the state. So it was very much an economic development strategy. So the provisions of Goal 8 that developed from that effort included these key elements, that the site had to be relatively large, 160 acres or more. It had to have 50% open space. It had to have developed visitor accommodations and developed recreational facilities, at least 150 units of overnight lodging. And then there were also, and this has been a main point of the destination resort law over the years and something that's changed, is the ratio of overnight accommodations to owner-occupied units. And so a 2-to-1 ratio for Western Oregon, a 2.5-to-1 ratio for Central and Eastern Oregon, and then limits in terms of commercial uses. There were also limits.
Can I just ask you a question, because I haven't read the... Now, this is in rule. Is that correct? Or this is currently in statute, those criteria?
Chair Dingfelder, it's important to note that these provisions are in both statute and statewide planning goal at this point. So they exist in parallel at two legal levels.
Okay.
So changing just one of them doesn't necessarily change what the law is on the ground.
And then just a follow-up on the legislative history of the 2-to-1 versus 2.5-to-1, was that based on, you know, I'm thinking carrying capacity, was it based on trying to attract, you know, or have more visitors? Bob, you've been around.
Chair Dingfelder, I think it was 1987, these provisions were originally in Goal 8 only. Goal 8 was put into statute in order to change, I think, one provision. Since then, there have been some adjustments to that statute, and we've simply followed suit by changing the goal. That's part of what we're going to be talking about today. And I believe it was the 2003 session. I hope I have that right. Was it 2001?
I was here, so... And
2001 session, the resort community sought from the legislature to increase the ratio in Central and Eastern Oregon. That was quite a long discussion involving the governor's office as well, and finally the legislature did enact at that time a different ratio for Central and Eastern Oregon.
Great, thank you.
So, Chair Dingfelder, I think it gets back to the balance between the visitor-oriented focus of the program, while recognizing, in part based on the experience coming out of Salishan, Sun River, some of those older resorts, that you do need, in order for these uses to survive economically, some owner-occupied housing. And so it's been a balance between those two things.
Madam Chair?
Senator?
You want to take questions after this presentation?
Why don't, since I interrupted the director, why don't you keep going, and then we'll take questions, as I'm sure there's going to be several questions.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
If you can hold that, that would be great.
So the other key elements that are in Goal 8 and also now in statute are protections to protect the characteristics, resources of certain areas. So the basic process that's set up in law is that counties are authorized to map areas that are eligible for destination resorts. Once that mapping is done, they still then have to go through a permit approval process. These are limitations on where counties can map areas for destination resorts. So not within 3 miles of a high-value cropland, not on primary unique ag soils, not in Class 1 and 2 forest land, sensitive game habitat. There's also a limitation which isn't on here, I apologize for that, within 20 5 air miles of a urban area with a population of 100,000 or more. So where are we today in terms of destination resort development on the ground and in terms of what's been approved through the planning process? In addition to the historical destination resorts that I started with, we have 8 counties that have mapped areas that are eligible for destination resorts. And we have other counties that have continued to use, and that's still an option under the law, this exceptions or variance process to authorize resorts. That translates into over 10 destination resort sites that are authorized at this point. Most of them are in Central Oregon. There are a couple along the coast that have been approved but not built. And then to take it down into a little bit more detail, this is a chart of resorts that have been approved in Central Oregon. It does not include 3 areas that have been mapped more recently, 2 in Jefferson County and 1 in northern Klamath County. But you can see at the bottom there, you've got some of the totals in terms of acreage, lots approved, number of overnight units. That gives you a sense of scale of the uses that we're talking about. And then finally, this may be a little bit difficult to read, and I had to stretch the map out a little bit to make it fit, but the areas in purple on this map are the areas that have been mapped as eligible in Central Oregon for destination resort siting. And you can see up in the top left corner, you have the 2 sites that have been approved by Jefferson County. And then you have the sites in Deschutes County and Crook County. Again, I'll note there is a site that has recently not only been mapped, but actually the initial master plan approval has been given by Klamath County in northern Klamath County, just south of this area that's shown on the map. So that's just a very quick snapshot of where we are in terms of destination resort development in the state. I wanted to speak just very briefly about a governor's bill that has been introduced in the House, and it's House Bill 2227 that would provide an opportunity for the state to examine where we are in the destination resort program, what's working, what's not working, where there have been issues, and probably most importantly, to adapt, fine-tune the program so that we don't necessarily have a program that has the same requirements across the state, but we have a program that recognizes the fact that we've had a lot of success in terms of destination resort development in some parts of the state. Other areas have struggled to get destination resorts underway. So providing some regional variation in the ground rules for destination resorts, try to encourage them in certain parts of the state, perhaps not encourage them in other parts of the state. So that's what the overall intent of that House Bill 2227 is. And it would also direct my commission, the Land Conservation and Development Commission, to go into a Goal 8 amendment process with a series of 10 public hearings across the state to get public input on how we should adapt the program. So that concludes my brief overview of where we are on destination resorts. I'd be happy to entertain questions.
Great. Thank you very much, Director. Senator Hess?
Yes. Thank you. First of all, those minimum rules, did you say those were in law? Are those rules like a $7 million?
So, Chair Dingfelder and Senator Haas, those provisions are in both state statute and statewide planning goal, which is effectively an administrative rule.
In both.
Okay, so you can raise I was just curious about the $7 million. That could be a golf course that's at a high elevation or near a lake, or is it a statute? Is it hotel accommodations? What?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Haas, I think the original concept, again, you have to think back to what was the model for destination resorts. You think about Sun River, think about Salishan, think about Black Butte Ranch. So they're all have developed recreational facilities. That was part of the idea was to help draw visitors to those facilities, draw in the dollars as an economic development strategy to bring revenue into local government. I think that's the idea behind there being a minimum requirement.
Chair Dinkler, if I could, mm-hmm. Senator Haas, the $7 million in developed recreation was also one of several provisions in originally in Goal 8 and then in statute to make sure we were really talking about something that is on the scale of Salishan or Sun River. This is one of the things that assures us it's a destination resort. Because these provisions are in statute, we can't amend Goal 8 unilaterally to change that number or update it without also changing the statute.
If I may
follow up?
Is that public? I mean, is that you're counting private, you know, lots that somebody might have bought at a
That's developed recreational facilities. I think back then it probably a golf course wouldn't have done it, but as you know, the times have changed, and we do see many resorts that meet that by developing a golf course, perhaps other recreational facilities, but it's an investment in developed recreation facilities. It doesn't count the residences.
It doesn't count the residences. Okay. Well, I think the crux of my question is on the overnight lodging. You know, obviously, you know that there are some of those resorts that are not meeting that part of it, that have sold the lots and built the golf course, and built an individual lot. You know, buyers have built very nice homes there, but they haven't been able to build the overnight accommodations or the amenities. And I know in some cases they put bonds up. What happens when they don't do that? How does that play out? If they go through, I think there's a 5-year window of opportunity, if you will. And what happens when they lose the bond? I mean, how is that supposed to play out?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Haas, I think you have to look on a case-by-case basis to see exactly what conditions each county imposed on each resort to see what the enforcement mechanism is to assure that overnight, the visitor accommodations are actually being developed as was promised by the resort developer. I know from discussions with Deschutes County, Klamath County on exactly this issue, those counties are actively working and looking at what has been built in terms of visitor accommodations. There are some situations where particular resorts have not met their conditions, and in each case, the county is working with the property owner to bring them into compliance. And we're being kept apprised of that by the counties, but I think the counties take that seriously. We don't have any counties here, I don't think, to testify about this today, but that's an issue for the counties also in terms of how do we enforce this over time. I think that's one of the things that we believe needs to be looked at as part of this reexamination of the siting laws.
Who is the property holder? If you have a golf course that sells, you know, 200 lots, and there's 200 property holders, who is liable for that?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Haas, again, that's going to depend on each circumstance and to some extent on where that property is in the development process. Early on, you'll still have the developer around and responsible for that. Later, as lots are sold, typically a homeowners association or some other entity will take over management. So, and it's going to depend on the particulars. If there was a bond, who was put on the hook for the bond, what the terms of the bond are in terms of whether it can be assigned to other people. You really have to look at it on a case-by-case basis. Under current law, it's a separate question what we should be doing.
Okay. Other questions?
Right. Okay.
Thank you. If you want to go on to the big look.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. So, switching gears, I'm now going to give you a quick presentation on the efforts and the recommendations coming out of Oregon's Big Look Task Force. You all recall back to the 2005 legislative session, Senate Bill 82 created the Oregon Big Look Task Force, a group of 10 members appointed by the governor, the president, and the speaker. And they've been working away for the last 2.5 years and have proposed legislation. There is also a final report from the Big Look Task Force, and you will be receiving individual copies of the report from the Big Look Task Force within the next couple of days if you have not already. So, good.
Well, we have the handout, so while we're trying to figure that out.
I apologize. I'm not
sure which button.
Did you just hit page down? There you go.
Okay. There's a blank in there.
Nice.
So what I'm going to do is focus really just on the recommendations today. Not going to talk so much about the process. We'd be happy to talk to you about that if you want as well, but just trying to give you a quick sense of the recommendations. First of all, we have 19 statewide planning goals. There is a sense among the task force that we really need a, for lack of a better term, vision statement, a statement of what outcomes our land use program should be trying to achieve in the state, not to replace the statewide planning goals, but to frame the program. So that's their first recommendation. There are a series of recommendations that are directed in encouraging regional initiatives. The first of those is in the area of protecting farms, forests, and natural areas. And that recommendation, I'm going to get into the detail on that in a sec, reducing complexity in our land use system, strategic planning, coordinating among state agencies, prioritizing infrastructure funding, and then in terms of governance, aligning our annexation laws with some of our land use laws. They're in the report, when you look at it, you will see a series of non-legislative recommendations. I'm not going to talk about those today. Those are directed primarily to state agencies rather than to the legislature. So I talked about the four overarching principles. They are provide a healthy environment, sustain a prosperous economy, desirable quality of life, and fairness and equity. Again, these would be put in statute as a framework, things that LCDC and state and local government would need to consider when adopting new land use laws or interpreting existing laws. Planning for regional initiatives, we have on the books a series of statutes that are known as regional problem solving. We've been working hard with local governments in the Bear Creek area on a regional problem-solving effort down there. I think coming out of that experience, there's some ideas about how to make that process work better and be more attractive to local government. So there's some recommendations there. A major area of initiative for the Big Look Task Force is on protecting farm, forest, and natural areas. The concept here is to authorize regions of the state to propose new regional criteria for what land should continue to be protected as farm or forest land. It would have to be done by two or more counties, would have to be reviewed by LCDC. There are some sideboards on there that are designed to assure that we continue to protect our ag industry and forest industries. Once those regional criteria are adopted, counties could then go through the process of amending their plan designations to conform to those new regional criteria. We're talking about some quantity of land being rezoned to uses other than farm or forest use. So another element of the task force recommendations is directed at those lands. What's the vision for lands that are not farm or forest land? What are we going to allow on those lands? So there are criteria in their recommendations in terms of types of use, extent of use, intensity of use to assure that that development is consistent with the carrying capacity of that land and is sustainable. There are also provisions in there requiring that if counties do this, because of some of the history of the way our land use program is set up in terms of protection of natural areas, that counties also go through an update of looking at what are the significant natural areas and resources within the county. Are they adequately protected under the county's existing programs, and to propose a new protection program for those natural resources and natural areas. There are also some other tools for managing rural lands, a proposal to allow, this is a situation we see primarily in central and eastern Oregon, but in some other parts of the state, a lot of lots that have been allowed to be created over time that are smaller than what's allowed by current law. So allowing some of that potential development capacity to be moved to areas where it makes more sense rather than having it spread out across the landscape through transfer of development rights. And then also some tools in terms of purchase of development rights to protect natural resources in natural areas. Reducing complexity, essentially a recommendation that there be both a technical audit of our existing land use system, statutory and rules, to reduce complexity, to then bring that technical review back to more of a policy, broader group of interest, to make sure that we have something that works more broadly, but essentially setting up a process to reduce complexity in our land use system. Strategic planning, recommendations for coordination between state agencies on planning, not only for land use, water, other resources, but also integrating planning in terms of how we invest state dollars with our planning program more carefully. Okay. There are some non-legislative recommendations in terms of citizen participation. In the area of infrastructure finance, there are recommendations for prioritization of infrastructure funding in terms of directing infrastructure funding to support efficient growth patterns in rapidly growing areas of the state. These are not intended to replace or take away existing criteria for investment that we already have as part of our system for both transportation dollars and water and sewer systems, but it's another essentially consideration for investment of those dollars. And then in terms of climate change, there are some non-legislative recommendations to Land Conservation and Development Commission. Similarly, in terms of economic development, recommendations to essentially continue some of the economic development initiatives that were really kicked off by the legislature back in 2001 and 2003. And that's a very quick run-through, the recommendations coming out of the Big Look Task Force. That bill is House Bill 2229, is the vehicle for those recommendations, and I believe it has been assigned to the House Land Use Committee.
That's right. Any questions for the director? I know you have to leave, so I just want to see if there's any questions. I know some of us have heard the presentation before and asked you many questions on this already, but any questions on this side? Jason? Okay.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for the opportunity, Chair Dingfelder.
Thank
appreciate
you for coming in. And I'm,
I have a
I'm,
question from Bob Rundy.
Is it germane to this?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure. We'll see.
Senator?
Did you raft any rivers during the summer?
So, did the snake this summer?
How was it?
Great.
Yeah. Enjoy it?
Yes.
Thank you very much. That's all I have.
Thank you.
Thank you again.
Thank you. Thank you for coming in. I'm sure we'll be seeing more of you.
That was the big look.
Look forward to it.
That was the big look, yes.
That's field research.
I've been on that river. It is a very nice river to float. Thank you very much, gentlemen, especially in such short notice.
No problem.
So with that, I will close the informational meeting part of our agenda. And I will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 79. A couple of things I wanted to go over. But Beth, why don't you go ahead and read us a summary.
Senate Bill 79 directs the Department of Energy to adopt an energy efficiency rating system for residential and non-residential buildings. It also requires the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, in consultation with the Department of Energy, to amend the state building codes with the goal of achieving net zero emissions by January 1st, 2030. In addition, it requires the DCBS director to develop and maintain an aspirational code that contains any economically and technically feasible standards that will aid in reaching that 2030 goal.
Okay. Great. Thank you, Beth. And before I invite people up to, we have a sign-up sheet here, so we're going to go work down the sign-up sheet. But before I do that, I just want to remind folks, when you come up, please make sure and state your name for the record. Please remember to do that. Otherwise, unfortunately, I have to interrupt you. So folks who are listening and not in the room today will know who you are. And second, if you do have written testimony, please hand that to our ABLE committee assistant over here, and I will ask you not to read your testimony but summarize the key points, because, again, I will probably interrupt you if that happens, because we all will have copies of it up here. So with that, I'm going to, let's see, do I see David Bantoff from the Governor's Office, Mark Long from the Department of Consumer and Business Services, Building Codes Division, and Betty Merrill from the Department of Energy. Could you all come up, please? And
Mark Long.
I lost my note. Got it.
Yes.
And Clark Brockman is here with us. He was the Energy Efficiency Working Group co-chair. So who wants to go first?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dave Bantoff, Governor's Sustainability Policy Advisor, and I'm going to be very brief, pretty much just wanted to just introduce the folks that are going to talk in more detail on the bill, but wanted to give just a real brief bit of context for this bill and how it got here. The governor has put together a package of legislation that he's hoping will move forward around climate change, and it covers several areas for greenhouse gas reductions. There's a just core greenhouse gas reduction focus. There's energy efficiency, renewable energy, and transportation. And so there's various bills that are kind of moving through the process that all collectively we think will have a significant impact on reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And in large part, this is in response to the good work that was done in the 2007 session by the legislature in terms of adopting significant greenhouse gas reduction goals for the state, which had built on some important steps that we had been taking previously, and then also some of the legislation in the 2007 session, like the Renewable Portfolio Standard and other pieces of energy efficiency legislation that helped us get started on making reductions. So we're hopeful that this session we can have a real large impact in terms of moving towards achieving those reduction goals. And this bill is really one of the centerpieces of that attempt, and has some very innovative concepts in it. So I'm going to let the agency's folks and Clark talk in more detail about that. But we're very excited about the bill and happy to be here and be happy to answer any questions that may come up after their testimony.
Great. Okay, thank you. So, Betty, do you want to go first or Mark?
Clark's
or? Okay, so Clark's going to do the overview. Thanks for being here today. I know you had to take off from work to come here.
You bet. It's my pleasure. My name is Clark Brockman. I live in Portland, Oregon. Do I need to give my address?
Okay. We'll find you if we need to.
And I work at Sarah Architects in Portland. As Dave said, I was the co-chair of the Energy Efficiency Work Group that worked all last summer on this. It was a big privilege, and I'm very excited to be here today. And thank you to the committee for hearing my testimony. First, I want to remind everyone, why are we even connecting buildings and climate change? And the numbers are striking. 48% of all the energy in America is used by buildings, and 75% of all the electricity is used by buildings. So if we're really trying to make a big impact, buildings actually can play a big role. That was kind of the driver for much of the work. The key goals of the Energy Efficiency Work Group's bill, especially, is twofold. As you know, there's the energy code upgrade with an aspirational goal of carbon neutral by 2030, and then there's the energy performance score. And I'm just going to hit the high points that really rose to the top after the work of the summer for the Energy Efficiency Work Group. First and most important is that we need an initial and significant code reset for the energy code in order to achieve the amount of efficiency that's readily available right now with today's technology, but not being done because it isn't required by code. And as you see in the bill, it's looking for a 30% increase in commercial code and a 15% increase in residential code. That is the key provision. Next after that was the current practice we have with energy codes. There's great uncertainty in the marketplace about what the next code will be and exactly when it will come into place. And if we could provide more certainty and clarity about how the code is going to improve, that would allow the marketplace to move much more quickly towards that next goal. And that is why we have the aspirational reach code provision within the measure. Then next, what we need is an aspirational goal to actually achieve carbon neutrality within buildings by the year 2030. This is a very common theme right now all across the country. Federal policy has adopted this. A number of states have adopted it in principle. But we actually believe that the bill being considered in Oregon is actually one of the most robust and significant in terms of rigor of actually achieving it. Next, it was important that we actually empower the agency to really have the authority to implement this and achieve the goals that we're setting forth, as opposed to those many bills that are occurring around the country that are setting the goals without any means to get there. And it's important that... And also to give the agency the authority to adjust measures over time as needed. We may get to a point where actually the desired increase in the code isn't readily achievable either based on technology or based upon the industry's ability to deliver. That's not true for the initial reset. We already know that's readily achievable, but as the code continues to progress, the agency should be given flexibility to adjust as needed to create off-ramps for either portions of the market or the whole market to catch up. Lastly, just a quick summary on the energy performance score component. This is based on the idea of it being analogous to our miles per gallon rating of our cars. If you know what the performance of your device or your building or your car is, it may change the way you purchase things. And so if at the time of sale, real estate provided the buyer with specific energy performance information on real estate, it may change the way people buy it and may change the way people prepare real estate for sale. So that is the basic idea. I know there will be other speakers that will go into more detail. I'm happy to answer any questions.
I think we're going to go through the whole panel and then we'll take questions. Thank you, Betty.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Betty Merrill from the Oregon Department of Energy. I'm going to direct my comments to the energy performance score or the first sections of the bill. This section of the bill directs the Department of Energy to establish energy efficient rating system for both commercial, non-residential buildings and residential buildings. The bill provides that these scores be implemented by January 1st, 2011 for residential and January 1st, 2012 for non-residential buildings. The bill also directs the Department of Energy to appoint a committee to help make recommendations on the energy performance methodology and the scores. The intent in the bill is to establish a rating system and then to develop an optional system for establishing a greenhouse gas emissions rating system and an optional simplified rating system for prospective buyers that would be used sort of as a yardstick when you're comparing properties so that either buyers or leasers of property can compare the basic energy use or energy efficiency of a building.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Mark Long. I'm the Administrator of State Building Codes. The Building Codes piece in this bill starts in Section 5. It's on the second page. And I think Clark did a pretty good job of going over the goals of the committee, and we've tried to capture those within the bill. I think it's important to note that when we adopt building codes at the state, those codes are uniform throughout Oregon. And so whatever we come up with will be applied on a statewide basis. The standard for energy conservation will be the same in Portland as it is in Phoenix or other areas around the state. This bill asks us to do a couple things. One, get an instant increase in the energy codes for both residential and commercial construction by 2012. That's the reset that Clark talked about. 15% for residential construction, 30% in this bill for commercial construction. After 2012, then my organization, should the bill pass, would create a reach code, or as the bill indicates in here, an aspirational code, which would be a voluntary code, which would be based on the latest and greatest new technology around energy standards, energy conservation standards. It would be something we'd want the market to essentially test or pilot before it became the mandatory code some 3 to 6 years later, after we had enough information about how that code went into effect, how it worked, and whatnot. And what we want to do between 2012 and 2030 is essentially get to a, as it's indicated in the bill, a net zero emissions building. Talking about definitions is hard. The definition in this bill sometimes can confuse you, but we're really talking about a building that can hopefully generate the energy that it uses on site and doesn't need any outside energy. That's the 30,000 foot view. The bill gives us the ability to what I call off ramps. If we're not able to reach that 2030 goal or some of the other goals that we set because it's economically or technically not feasible, we can kind of readjust our schedule and readjust how we move forward. And the bill also gives us the ability to take action and make sure that with the existing codes that we have and codes that we adopt in the future, we can harmonize all the pieces and make sure all this works to get to the ultimate goal. With that, I'll conclude my comments. I want to give you one last piece of information. Why this is important to our organization is it's very useful to have a plan as far as our targets or our goals for energy efficiency in this state, and we want to take that opportunity to do that, and this bill provides that. One of the things that you should know is a lot of folks say that between 2030 and 2040, we're going to either renovate or have a complete change of new buildings in state. About 75% of the buildings will be changed either through renovation or new construction. If we act now, we're going to be able to hit those goals for all that new construction that's going to occur here in the future. So we look at this as something that we need a plan, set forth how to get there, and really take advantage of the opportunity that we have here right now. With that, I will close.
Thank you. Let's see if there's any questions for the panel. Senator Boquist, Senator Haas.
Actually, a question, Administrator. Fiscal statement, are we waiting for something to come up?
It's my understanding that there will be a fiscal statement, but we have not gotten it yet.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Senator Haas.
Thank you. I'm just wondering what this looks like to consumers, particularly if you look at the residential buildings or houses. What will they have to do? You know, how does this work? How much will it cost? Is it somebody come in and rank their house? What if they get a low rating? You know, those sorts of things.
I'll take that.
Madam Chair, Senator Haas, when we're talking about the energy performance scores piece, it can vary a lot. Currently, Earth Advantage is doing a pilot with the Energy Trust of Oregon, going in and evaluating existing housing, trying to determine where they are with their system. And we're going to be closely monitoring that. The Oregon Department of Energy is also working very closely with the federal Energy Star program to see where those values compare to Oregon. In terms of cost, at this point, we know that you can go a very simplified approach, that you could basically develop a tool and then possibly be able to train folks either in the appraisal, real estate, one of those types of industries to be able to do a gross yardstick on each home. That would probably be something in the, you know, $50 range to a full-blown home energy audit and rating system, which could identify everything that you could do to improve the building, which would be, you know, probably $200. So kind of on that continuum, there's a big range.
A follow-up?
So would this be something that would be borne by that consumer then, and they'd be required to do this based on every year, every 10 years when they sell their house?
Madam Chair, Senator Haas, yes, the bill would require this to be done at point of sale. So when the house is marketed for sale, change of ownership, it would occur. I'm guessing that the fee would go with the seller of the property.
If I may?
Yeah, go ahead.
In many ways, it's analogous to what is now currently required by financing, which is the home inspection. Every house that's sold generally has a home inspection, and I actually think there's some negotiation about who pays for that. So in terms of who pays for that, I think that could be an open question, but it is very analogous to that, and in many ways I think it's providing information that is as valuable as the home inspection.
Okay. I appreciate that, Madam Chair, but I don't think that's required in law. I think it's often required by lenders, but it's not required by the state.
Correct.
Okay. Senator Atkinson?
The public purposes charge that all Oregonians pay goes to weatherize homes of folks that in some cases can't afford to have that done. Is there any part of the Oregon Department of Energy's research in this area to say that those homes or that are weatherized as part of public purposes would be a test for this before we spring it on the public at large, or is there any coordination between those weatherization programs and this program?
Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, the 1149 public purpose funds are going to primarily the Energy Trust. A portion goes to housing for weatherization programs. Those homes would obviously be included in this requirement, and we're working closely with housing to be able to figure out how we can leverage this funding, because the intention at the Energy Efficiency Working Group, one of the biggest things they identified was existing housing as a potential energy saver. And so those buildings would be included, and yes, we could look at that.
Okay. Other questions?
Go ahead,
Senator Boquist, and then Senator Prasansky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like the Department of Energy to come back either to me as an individual member or to the committee. And I can't believe $50 or $200 for an auditor inspection. I mean, a home inspection now costs a whole lot more. I'd like to see some statistics or some entity that says they can do it for $50.
I've had one done personally, so I can share how much it cost of my house. Senator Prasansky. Yeah.
So walk us through this. We have this going on law. And if someone has an existing house, they have this check done, they're going to get a rating. I'm just going to use the scale since it's not been set 1 to 100. Then walk me through, if the rating's 25 versus 50 versus 75, are we going to set a threshold and say that every house has to be at a certain level before it can be sold, and then the buyer or seller are going to have to decide on how they get that rating up to whatever the minimum level is, or what?
Madam Chair, Senator Prasansky, the bill doesn't say that you have to receive a given score. What the bill does is directs the department to establish a system for rating homes.
I understand that, but I'm looking, let's say, two or three legislations down the road. Mm-hmm. Once we got this in place, there's got to be some thought that this group has done as to what's the goal and objective besides telling the potential owner, or let's say new owner, that this house is rated at this level. I mean, are we not looking beyond just rating the houses?
Senator Prasansky, you're very astute, and the committee did talk about that. It was deemed
tell
very
them that, would you?
It was very important first to get the program
on.
To get the program in place, and we kept coming back to the miles per gallon sticker that we get on our car. To date, there are very few regulations about what requirements are associated with that, and it's really just information for use by the consumer, right? If we do have changes in the CAFE standards in the coming years, that might change. It is analogous to that. It clearly gives the government also information that it could use in years to come to increase efficiency, but I think we're also going to need an entire energy efficiency industry to develop in order to be able to deliver all of those services. Right now, it's spotty, but it does exist. There are groups who do it. They usually center around the Energy Trust and Earth Advantage right now, but clearly it's going to expand in the near term, and that will give a lot of people a lot of choices.
David.
Madam Chair, Senator Prasansky, I just add to what was just said. In my participation in the work group, the intent was that this was going to be an educational tool, that informational tool for folks to have. And one of the possible outcomes would be that, you know, whether it's a 25, 30, whatever the number is, the score, also suggestions on what could be done to the home or building to improve its energy performance. Again, not requiring anything, but giving them those pieces of information that are available today, but not in that kind of a easy-to-use fashion. fashion where it happens at the point of transaction. And so the hope is that folks would see that they could make investments in the home or building that would save them money over time in terms of their utility bills because of making this information available.
Thank you.
I have a question, Mark, for you. Can you talk about Oregon's building codes and where we are in comparison to other states as far as energy efficiency?
Madam Chair, on the residential code, you may know that just in 2008, we increased our residential code over our previous code by 15%. That puts us in, I'm going to check with Betty, within the top two or three states. In the country on the residential side. On the commercial side, you want to answer? You might know from the design side.
I can't tell you in the top. I'm guessing we're in the top 10, but we are 25% better than the national standard, which is ASHRAE 90.1.
Right.
That's where we currently sit. California sits at about 20%, so they're slightly better. Washington's right in the same with us. But the West Coast states are some of the best in the country.
Okay. Madam Chair, one other thing just to kind of get back at the previous conversation. I want to make sure everybody knows that for this bill and building codes, you're talking about new construction, no retroactivity whatsoever. So the building code standards are things that are going forward with a new home or a new commercial business or whatever. Okay.
And what about for renovations?
Renovations do not trigger any energy upgrades except for the area that you're renovating. So if you're changing your furnace system, you have to use whatever the code requires for a new furnace system. If you change your window, you have to use the new window. But if you don't touch that, there's no requirement in the building code that that's upgraded as part of this or our current system. In the commercial side, it's a little more complicated because it gets into use. If you went from a warehouse, as an example, which may not have much energy features, to a residential or mixed use, then you'd have some upgrading there. But essentially, if you leave your home or business alone, the building code does not ask you to go back and do retrofits.
Okay. Senator Boquist, and then we're going to move on to the
I'm yielding my time to Senator Przanski, Madam Chair.
That's because he's astute.
Mark, regarding that, let's say there are people that have historic registered homes or whatever it may be. They're supposed to keep it, like, to say, on the windows, that caught my attention, leaded glass or leaded pane. I mean, what are we talking about? I mean, if they were going to upgrade, or they're going to have to actually replace that and go to a new 21st century window, or what?
No. Madam Chair, Senator Przanski, Betty's wanting to answer the question, but I know that we have provisions in the code for historical buildings and exemptions for those special situations, and especially around windows and whatnot.
Yeah.
Okay.
By the way, some of us noticed that when the wings were renovated, that the windows were not. And so I don't know if we're within code, but I can tell you that there's a lot of heat leaking out of those windows. Just don't come to my office. Go to Senator Przanski's office. But no, seriously, well, thank you very much for your testimony. I'm sure we'll be talking to you some more. And we have a lot of folks who'd like to share their thoughts with us today, so we'll move on to the next few folks, and I'm going to call people up together. That doesn't always necessarily mean that they are on the same side of this issue, but because of our time constraints, we'll ask people to come up as I call their names. Unfortunately, Bill Cross had to leave, but he did submit some testimony for the record, which we will pass out, and he wanted to share that he is representing the Building Owners and Managers Association. And he said he supports the bill's they support the bill's concept, but they have some concerns about specific goals. So I think he's handing out his testimony. Okay, so I'm going to call up Ramona Baker, Eric Storm, and Leonard Loader. And I'm sorry if I've mispronounced your name. And again, if you can please state your name, and if you do have an affiliation, if you're representing somebody, for the record. Okay, why don't you, on the end here, is this Leonard?
Eric.
So why don't you get started since you're all ready to go.
All right, good. Good afternoon. My name is Eric Storm, and I'm the project coordinator with the Energy Performance Score Pilot by Energy Trust. I'm sorry, Earth Advantage. Sean Penrith, the executive director of Earth Advantage, couldn't be here today, so he asked me to step in his place. And I'm not a public speaker, so bear with me. I'm more of a hired geek.
You're doing great.
Thank you. But basically, I'll briefly cover what our pilot is, and I think it speaks mainly to the feasibility of the Energy Performance Score, and I'll be happy to answer questions at the end. The Energy Performance Score is a miles per gallon types rating system for energy use in new and existing homes. The EPS measures homes' energy consumption and carbon emissions and expresses these as energy and carbon scores with comparisons to regional averages and efficiency goals. The report that accompanies the certificate includes performance analysis of the various energy-related elements of the home and recommendations for cost-effective improvements. Homeowners will be able to compare their EPS scores to those of other homes, take measures to improve those scores, and use enhanced energy performance as a valuable selling point. The EPS pilot currently being conducted by Earth Advantage has been supported by the Energy Trust of Oregon. To date, we have audited 300 homes in Portland and Bend and are now in the process of calculating the energy use of each home using different software modeling tools. We will compare the results from the different tools with actual energy use that Energy Trust is providing to measure the accuracy of the different tools. We've been conducting research, surveys, and focus groups to determine the most useful metrics and how best to express home energy performance to the public. We'll be issuing a report of those results this spring. And there's been national interest in watching our pilot, as it seems at the state as well. One of the goals of the pilot is to identify rating tools and protocols that would provide accurate and useful performance scores in the most cost-effective ways. If a score isn't accurate enough, the price isn't really going to matter. If it's too simple, it won't have many legs in the marketplace. Consumers surveyed have indicated a willingness to pay up to $200. That's a number that's guided our efforts in this. Typical audits in the country range widely based on the quality and the detail offered. I would say at the low end, it could easily be twice that at about 400 and goes up to 1,000, totally depending on what kind of service is being offered in that audit. Sean Penrith also mentioned that some financial entities have expressed an interest in supporting the EPS by covering a portion of the audit, making it more affordable. The EPS is being designed to offer benefits to a range of stakeholders. I'll outline just a few of them here. I do have a handout I can pass to you later that shows an example draft certificate, which I'll pass over. Coupled with the governor's proposal for proposed financing plan to offer loans for energy efficiency upgrades, the EPS can serve as an accounting tool to ensure that a home has reached the energy improvement potential after the investments and upgrades have been made. The EPS will help contractors and homeowners prioritize energy upgrades in terms of impact and cost effectiveness. It can spur the creation of preferred mortgage and insurance products based on EPS scores. The EPS provides a common metric for incentive programs such as those offered by Energy Trust and state and federal governments. And finally, a minimum mandated EPS threshold can be aligned with carbon reduction goals as defined by the state, the Western Climate Initiative, or AIA's 2030 challenge. In conclusion, the EPS score would create a common metric whereby homeowners, financial institutions, and government and nonprofit entities could create programs that greatly increase the opportunities and likelihood for energy upgrades. The EPS report will lower the barriers to making changes by providing the homeowner with a customized and prioritized list of upgrades, directing them to the necessary resources. The EPS will help to define the way forward for reducing home energy use and allow us to measure the progress we're making towards those goals. And I'm happy to answer any questions you may have. And if it's useful, I have an example of a draft certificate and a list of some of the things that would be included on the report.
Great. You can give that to the committee staff when you're done. Any questions? Since this is not a organized panel, I'll just ask questions take questions separately. Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to clarify, you said you're trying to get a $200 fee to do this, but it could be between $400 and $1,000. Is that correct? Is that what I heard you say?
No, what's typical out in the country right now for a home performance audit is between $400 and $1,000, and our goal is to be somewhere much closer to $200, possibly less, given that seems to be the public threshold for this.
But the present rate is $400 to $1,000. Thank you.
Yes.
On a national basis.
Right.
On a national level.
Thank you very much.
How many? You talked about a pilot. You're doing pilot project. Can you talk about how many homes or businesses are involved in that, and
right.
just a little more detail about that?
Sure. As I mentioned, we've done 300 homes, existing and new, in Portland and Bend, and we're collecting a lot of different data to allow us to enter that into various software tools to see which ones can provide the accuracy that's necessary and be time effective. The national standard, which is usually the HERS index, they use a REM rate program, often takes 3 or 4 hours to do an audit, hence the price. What we're trying to find are tools that are equally accurate, if not more so. As it turns out, the national standard isn't very accurate. But to come up with something much more accurate in a time frame that's much reduced, something under an hour, if we can get somewhere between 30 minutes to 45 minutes, we think we can have a very cost-effective way of auditing a home. And if we've shown that it's at least as accurate as the national standard, we think we have something.
Okay. And then I'll ask you about, you know, under Section 1, it talks about the state doing this, the Department of Energy. So can you talk a little bit about how, because you have a program now, I mean, obviously we don't want to duplicate something that's already being done. So was that discussed? I know you were a member of the working group. There have been discussions about using the information that you have or how that would work?
Right. I have somewhat limited knowledge on that, but I'll speak mm-hmm. to the best I can. My understanding is that, I think it's even mentioned in here, that part of the advisory group and things as they create the tool for the state that they'll be looking at, I think on line 18, page 2, the success of pilot programs such as ours. So I think there is an eye to what we're doing to see what's possible. I don't know if this is totally true, but whether or not our tool can be adopted by the state and other places. As I said, there's national interest. I imagine it will get used by various agencies.
Okay, great. Thank you. Any other questions?
No, we'll
move on to the next witness. Okay. Ramona?
For the record, Ramona Baker. And first, I would just like to thank Chair Dingfelder and the committee members for hearing my testimony in support of Senate Bill 79. I am the Energy Policy Associate for Environment Oregon, and Environment Oregon is a statewide, citizen-based environmental advocacy organization. So I'd like to begin by briefly speaking about why this bill is so important to our economy and environment in Oregon, and then provide some specific comments on the bill. So first of all, this bill has some clear economic benefits. It would further Oregon's leadership in the green building industry, encouraging companies such as the green architecture firms in Portland, as well as manufacturing companies like Geldwin, the high-efficiency window manufacturing company stationed in Klamath Falls. This bill, of course, would also correspond to a great amount of saved money on energy bills for businesses and families in Oregon. Secondarily, there's the clear benefit of reductions in global warming pollution for Oregon. In fact, 43% of our emissions come from building energy use. So energy efficiency must be a central piece to reduce emissions. In fact, Environment Oregon estimates that the programs articulated in this bill will reduce our emissions by 5.2 million metric tons by 2020, which, to put that in context, that's roughly the same amount that Boardman emits on an annual basis. So that, of course, means greater energy savings and reduced global warming emissions. To comment more specifically on the bill itself, first of all, the bill, as we've already heard, creates a system to disclose building energy efficiency performance. And this system is critical for potential buyers to be able to make informed decisions about purchasing a building. As we've already referenced, there's the analogy of the miles per gallon rating system for cars. And it seems only fitting that we should be able to have a similar estimation with buildings as to their energy efficiency. And since that's not readily available right now in terms of disclosure of information for energy efficiency with buildings, we recommend that this disclosure of energy efficiency performance be mandatory. And then secondarily, the bill, of course, articulates the building code program, which would put Oregon on track to be constructing net zero energy buildings by 2030. And this includes requiring routine improvements in the codes throughout the years, and includes the aspirational code, which, again, as has been referenced, this is absolutely critical for builders so that they can be looking towards the future as they're building now and knowing what the building codes will be in the future. It also gives builders the opportunity to volunteer to build towards an even greener code and then market their buildings as such. Furthermore, it allows cities to actually adopt the aspirational code if they wish to have a stronger code than that's being implemented at the state level. So we recommend that the aspirational code, in fact, be mandatory for publicly owned buildings, just to further the actual energy savings and global warming pollution reduction goals. So again, this is a very critical bill in terms of our Oregon economy and our environment. And I would be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Ms. Baker? Okay, thank you. And then Mr. Loader, and you can just maybe shift the microphone over a little bit. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Leonard Lauder.
Lauder, I apologize.
I didn't come equipped with a large enough bucket, so they can't call me a loader. Sorry. I'm an architect in Salem at Studio 3 Architecture, and I'm also on the executive committee of the American Institute of Architects for the state of Oregon. And as an organization, we have been heavily involved over the last number of years, pressing for reduction, obviously, in energy, higher performance buildings, energy independence, reducing carbon, our carbon footprint, et cetera. In all of those areas, in previous sessions, we've been pressing forward with our own legislative efforts, and we certainly stand behind what this particular piece of legislation is presenting to us. Others here have already said significantly, have said a lot about the energy side of it. I'd like to point out that with respect to building codes, we often forget that building codes are really sort of the lowest common denominator in the industry. As professionals, we're often working far ahead of where the code requires us to be, and we would certainly advocate for codes moving in the direction where the profession and the industry actually operates. We certainly also advocate for the 2030 standard, and we would urge Oregon in particular to maintain its sort of frontline place in terms of energy efficiency. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for coming today. Appreciate your testimony. Question?
Yeah, I just want to throw this out. I mean, what I'm hearing is that what we're trying to do is get the house to be more efficient energy-wise. And my understanding is that you're going to try to seal the house so it doesn't have a lot of leaks in it and stuff like that. I'm just wondering if you could throw out, are we also needing, I mean, what steps are we taking to make certain that we don't increase mold? Or is it radon gas, those type of emissions, by closing and sealing that the structures to that point? And I'm going to throw that out for the more technical people who might be more engaged. I don't know, Ron, if you have information on that too.
Actually, energy efficiency in new construction isn't necessarily a case of sealing the structure up. It's working with the building structure in a way so that energy is managed, that ingress and egress of air, moisture-laden air, is properly handled. So long as we keep moving moisture-laden air, for instance, through controlled means, we can seal other parts of the building up and avoid the problems that you're referring to. Okay. And that technology is something that most of my profession certainly understands and understands well.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate you coming here today and sharing your testimony. Okay. Next up is Sean Jillians from the Oregon Association of Realtors. We have Todd Wynn, Cascade Policy Institute, and Erica Hagendorn. I hope I'm not ruining somebody else's name. Nick New. I thought I got that right, Erica. Hey, Sean.
I'm up.
Welcome. I knew Sean when he was...
just a young lad,
young
right?
lad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Sean Jillian's representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I certainly would agree with a lot of the previous testimony as far as there are benefits to energy audits. I think the energy audits are a commendable thing for those consumers who wish to have them done on their homes, or as the bill goes, to commercial building, industrial building, any other building, since it just says residential and non-residential. Unfortunately, where we differ is the mandatory portion of it. Voluntary incentive-based systems seem to more readily achieve the desired result, which I think, Senator Prozanski, you mentioned, of actually making changes to the homes. If we just give flat scores to people who just had to pay $500 for it, there's no guarantee that those changes are actually going to be made, and it's not actually an incentive to do that. I think you'll see other bills this session that might actually present some incentives as far as low-interest loans and things to make the changes. However, a flat across-the-board $500 fee, or in my research so far and looking at other cities that have thought about doing this, the typical rate is $350 for a simple energy audit, $600 to $900. That might not sound like a lot in a transaction of a home, but in this market, that is a lot of money. That's a lot of money for someone, regardless of if it's the seller or the buyer in this. And I would agree with the previous point as well as far as the economy of Oregon. I think this does impact the economy of Oregon. However, I don't think that it's going to have the stimulative impact that people are talking about. I think we've seen the collapse of the housing market and the damage it's done to this state, and to further hinder any sales and... when we met this morning, I showed you some market data from your area of the state that is quite grim. And I think, honestly, a $900 difference could be the difference between a sale and not having a sale. So we have serious concerns with this bill. We certainly think that energy audits are a good thing on a voluntary basis for those consumers who want them. And I'd be happy to answer any questions, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do not use this year, because we know we're not going where we want to be in the economy. But let's say 2 years ago, on average, how many houses are sold in the entire state? How big of group are we talking about?
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, in a healthy real estate market, between 2% and 5% of the housing stock turns over. So if we assume that we get back to a healthy market, which we're all pushing for, it would take between 25 and 50 years before all the homes in Oregon received an energy audit at that pace.
How many per year?
Yeah. But that 2 to 5% represents what?
In absolute numbers.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'd have to get back to the committee on how many 5, actual 000, sales there 6, are. 000. No, it's a much greater number than that.
Madam Chair, if you could get back to it.
Absolutely. I'll bring those numbers back.
I'm sure that Sean will.
Yeah, because, Madam Chair, I'm kind of looking for the class of people and the impact on a yearly basis is what I'm looking for.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Erica.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Erica Hagedorn here today on behalf of industrial customers of Northwest Utilities. I can never state anything as well as Sean could, but just two brief points. We support a voluntary system. We think the information can be available today without a bill. And we support the home builders' efforts and the realtors' efforts to get the job done in a workable solution for the folks who work on this issue every day.
Great, thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, first of all, I'd like to say the first part of this bill,
state your name, please.
Oh, yes. My name is Todd Wynn, and I am the economist for Cascade Policy Institute.
And Todd, you can stand back a little bit.
Okay.
These are very sensitive microphones, so we'll hear your breathing otherwise. So.
The energy performance certificates, I'm lukewarm about the idea. First, having better consumer information is always a good thing so that they can truly value the amenities and the value of the home. However, I'd caution this committee on doing it for existing buildings. That's quite a daunting task to enter the homes of all the existing residential buildings and commercial buildings across the state. And then the second part of the bill I don't agree with at all. It's completely counterintuitive to economic principles. If a consumer has better information about the energy efficiency of the home, there's no need to provide codes. If they truly value energy efficiency of this home, then they will demand it via the market, and builders will provide it. Also, by imposing building codes and strict building codes and actually enforcing these building codes, you're definitely going to increase the cost of homes and commercial buildings in the state. And as the other member down here said, it's tough to do this in a time of already an economic downturn, especially in this sector. You're really painting builders into a corner as far as that's concerned. You can pass mandates, but you can wave a magic wand, but making these goals actually really truly happen is not based in reality at all. A goal for net zero emissions homes by 2030 is just not even realistic at all. You can let consumers choose once they have perfect information on this, and if they desire more efficient buildings, then builders will provide it. Thank you very much.
Okay. Questions for the panel? Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate you coming in today. And our last panel, or I should say the last folks who've signed up, and then we'll hear briefly, just so committee members know, from DEQ, since they came all the way here today from Portland. Make sure we don't want to have to make them come back and burn more greenhouse gases. Jim Edelson, if you can come up. Tom O'Connor and Martha Pellegrino. And Jim, I know you have to leave. I'm sorry, I didn't get that message. So if you want to go first,
okay.
You have to sneak out. That's fine. Good afternoon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. My name is Jim Edelson. I'm a building codes and energy consultant. As a building codes consultant, I've served on the State of Wisconsin Commercial Building Codes Commission. I've served on the National ASHRAE Building Advanced Technical Guide Committee, and I'm also served on the Energy Efficiency Work Group and helped develop this 2030 proposal. What I first really want to go through, since a lot of the other points were covered, is this attachment that I've given to you on page 2. This is the well-respected McKinsey study, which evaluates the U.S. mid-range abatement curve for greenhouse gas emissions in 2030. And if you look at this curve, there's a solid line in the middle, and those measures to the left are all below that line, and the measures to the right are all above that line. If you look to the measures on the left, those are measures to reduce greenhouse gas emissions that actually save consumers money, up to $90 a ton of savings to consumers. And what I want you to recognize in that graph is that 7 of the 9 of the most cost-effective measures for U.S. greenhouse gas abatement, and this is representative of national models, including Oregon, 7 of those 9 will be impacted by this 2030 bill. These are related to commercial and residential construction, and especially the new construction covered in the 2030 codes. So as we go about our greenhouse gas emissions reductions, please keep in mind that if we do anything, which we have to do, I believe, these are the most cost-effective measures, and these are the ones. I'm glad you're hearing this bill early, because these are the ones that should get done first. I would also like to address a little bit more about the Section 6 of the bill, which are the near-term targets. Right now I'm a consultant for the New Buildings Institute in Vancouver, Washington. And nationally I'm working on similar code proposals across the nation, cities, and states. And I want to talk about Section 6 of the bill, which calls for 15% reductions in residential energy consumption and 30% in commercial construction. These are really feasible goals. These are the types of proposals we're talking about all over the country. I list under that heading the ASHRAE Advanced Energy Design Guide Committee, on which I serve, the Core Performance Guide, California's Title 24, the next version, ASHRAE SP 189, the Energy Trust of Oregon Incentive Program, which is going to be based on the Core Performance Guide. These are all levels that are going to just be what we're going to be requiring for code in 2012. So what I want to say is these are cost-effective, they've been measured, and they're feasible. It's off-the-shelf technology, and there's no reason that our state to get on this path should not be requiring these by January 1st, 2012. And I hope you pass SB 79 out of this committee as soon as possible.
Great. Thank you so much, Jim. Questions? We lost a couple of committee members. Okay. Martha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Martha Pellegrino, and today my affiliation is with the City of Portland's Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. They were our certified smart people were unable to come down today, so they have sent me. The good news is a number of the comments have been made so eloquently on the record about the benefits of this bill in terms of economic development, in terms of energy savings, and in terms of reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. And I also actually would like to publicly thank the Governor's Energy Efficiency Working Group because they did tremendous work in order to put forward this bill and a number of others. What I will say is that some of the elements of this bill are very consistent with some of the work that's going on in Portland, and the city has been looking at a couple of different ways of pursuing high-performance green building, both through its development services and through the Bureau of Planning Sustainability, and we'd be very, very supportive of the state taking the lead on this and being very and playing a supportive role. So thanks very much for bringing this bill forward, and to the extent possible, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Okay. Any questions? City?
Question?
Yes, Senator Brzozowski.
Does Portland have some type of, I'm going to call it tax incentive for individuals who want to enter these programs to help them, one, either get the assessment done and or actually making changes once they know what the assessment, what the results are?
Madam Chair, Senator Brzozowski, at this point I know that our Sustainable Development Office is working with the Energy Trust and Utilities to develop some sort of pilot program, not necessarily on the elements of this bill, but in terms of doing energy efficiency upgrades. And that program, I think, is at least they're talking about trying something later this year. So there isn't a program in place, to my knowledge, but I can certainly get back to you with some more information about that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Mr. O'Connor.
For the record, Madam Chair, my name is Tom O'Connor with Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities Association. We represent 11 of the small municipal utilities in Oregon. I did serve on the Energy Efficiency Working Group. Just wanted to come up quickly and speak to the building code section of this bill. We do support the concept of regularly advancing the building code. From what we've found, it's always cheaper to do the energy efficiency measures up front than it is to come back in down the line later on and try to go into an existing building and retrofit them or weatherize them when you've got a lot of structural issues that you have to deal with. We also think the idea of the REACH code would fit in well with our incentive programs that we offer right now to folks to build beyond code, and that makes sense to us. A couple of quick cautions. One, need to make sure, as the department has always done in the past, to my knowledge, to make sure that as you move the code forward, it's done in a way that makes sense to builders and is acceptable to the building community. Because if it's not, it's just you're going to have enforcement nightmares. And the department, I think, has done a good job on that in the past. The second caution might be that I do think, as the department said, you need some off ramps. To make sure that those are in there. The concepts of, I agree with BOMA that the concepts of net zero and carbon neutral are a little bit problematic. We may need more work over time. I mean, from a distribution utility perspective, you can't simply go in and plunk down a PV system on every building in the community. The grid won't. Even a smart grid won't handle that. But there are ways to do that, and I think this is the ways to get at those goals, and I think this is a good, particularly the building code section makes a lot of sense to us.
Thank you for sharing your comments, all of you. Any questions? Senator Hess.
Thank you. Question for Jim. I'm intrigued by this. I can't believe I'm saying this, by the U.S. mid-range abatement curve, 2030.
It's on record, too.
Help us understand what the curve is.
Oh, yes.
I mean, You say residential buildings at the top.
Right. Chairman Klingfelter, Senator Haas. This curve was done by the McKinsey Institute, and it was an attempt to take what actual measures in the economy could be taken to reduce greenhouse gas emissions between now and 2030. And it took those as a bucket and then analyzed each individual one in terms of how much carbon it could be reduced and at what cost to the economy. And as you see, it's, you know, whether it's conservation tillage, cellulosic biofuels, or CFL lighting in homes, those were all buckets that were evaluated on an equivalent scale. And the ones to the left, as you see,
below the line,
they rated them, what would the cost be to consumers of doing this between now and 2030? And it turns out that, and we know this from deep experience here in Oregon and in California and across the country, that energy efficiency is cost effective and has paybacks in the terms of 6 months, depending on the energy efficiency measure. So these measures all were below the line have negative costs to reduce energy because they save consumers money.
Long term.
Oh yeah, but you know, if there's incentives, you know, these don't include the incentives, and these do not include the, you know, in terms of the consumer's perspective, they do not include the incentives or the rebates. So, for instance, the LED lighting is very cost effective because, you know, they last forever. They use almost no energy, and you know, every city should put those in stoplights, because they just make sense economically, and they use about one-tenth of the electricity.
And so you have solar up toward the right of the scale.
Yeah, solar PV is not the most cost-effective way to reduce carbon emission. Yeah.
And part of this is based on payback period.
Right. It's sort of an inverse, you know, to payback period.
Well, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
Then if residential buildings is at the furthest end of that,
but that's the HVAC.
Do you want to
explain that, Tim, on the far right?
Would that be included in part of what we're?
Yeah. What this is? This is actually not pursuant to this. This is not new construction. This is HVAC equipment efficiency switching out in existing buildings, I believe,
okay,
as opposed to new construction.
Okay.
Energy efficiency standards.
Car hybridization. I didn't even know that was a word, but
right,
it's way,
yeah,
at the furthest end.
Right, and of course, this was also done in 2007, I believe, based on 2005 and 2006 data. And as you know, technologies are changing very quickly, and the costs of many of these measures have shifted.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much, all of you, for coming today. And is there anybody else who would like to testify that did not sign up? They're just a separate informational. Okay. So with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 79, and we will definitely be working on this bill a bit more before it comes back, and certainly you'll be hearing more from folks who testified today. You'll be hearing more from the committee staff on that. I will open up a brief informational meeting. We're going to hear from Andy Ginsberg from the Department of Environmental Quality. I asked Andy to come here today, so we're going to give him a few minutes of our time because we will be hearing several of the DEQ bills in our committee and ask Andy to just provide a little bit of background. So you've got 5 minutes, Andy. I know you can be efficient. Do you have a PowerPoint or you'd rather just...
I think I'll skip the PowerPoint. Madam Chair, for the record, members of the committee, my name is Andy Ginsberg. I'm the Air Quality Administrator at DEQ. Excuse me. Thank you very much for having me here. And in the interest of time, I won't go through this presentation. You do have
maybe
several
you can make
of
it available to Beth, and then
yes,
we can send it out. Oh, perfect.
You do have a hearing next week on three of our bills, and I was going to provide some general background that will be relevant for when you're considering those bills, and I can work that into my testimony then. So I'll just say now that we have a number of air quality challenges in Oregon. We've made tremendous progress in cleaning up Oregon's air, but we still have challenges. One of the biggest ones is that EPA recently tightened the federal health standard for fine particulate, as you may recall, Madam Chair, just before last session. And we now have two areas of the state, Klamath Falls and Oak Ridge, that are violating that standard, have been formally designated as non-attainment, and three additional areas that we expect will violate as soon as we have enough monitoring data to formally designate them, and then many, many other areas where we're very close to the standard. And one of our bills, Senate Bill 102, addresses wood stove emissions, which, as it turns out, wood stoves are very significant contributors to violations of the federal air quality standard for fine particulate. And I'll explain that more next week. excuse me. We also, I was also going to mention that we have, in the air toxics arena, we also have many challenges. As you know, we've been focusing on diesel exhaust. Last session, you may recall, Madam Chair, that EPA was looking at the benzene standard in gasoline, and through a collective effort with legislators and the agency and our congressional delegation, we were successful in convincing EPA to reduce the level of benzene in gasoline in the Pacific Northwest, which is great, and we've taken additional steps since then to reduce leaks of benzene fumes in the gasoline distribution system. So we are making progress, but still we have with benzene and with diesel exhaust and with combustion byproducts, we are exceeding health benchmarks throughout the state. So we have a lot of work left to do there. And, of course, in the area of climate change, there's quite a bit of work, and you'll be having multiple hearings on that, so I won't dwell on it now. And with that, I'll just close, just in the interest of time, and answer any questions that you have.
I was going to say, I think we'll be seeing a lot of you, Andy, this session, but I appreciate you coming in today. I apologize that we sort of ran short on time. Are there any questions? Senator Przanski.
Andy, regarding the benzene, I understand there may be a bill that's already been introduced that would not allow for automobiles when they're filling up with gas to be topped off. Is that something that you'll be discussing at some time in the future?
Madam Chair, Senator Przanski, that was actually a regulation that the Environmental Quality Commission has already adopted. I'd be happy to provide a briefing on it. But it's EPA, just really briefly, EPA adopted a national rule requiring larger gas stations to have vapor recovery when the tanker truck comes and refills their underground tanks with gasoline. That's a strategy to reduce benzene emissions. And when the Environmental Quality Commission adopted that federal program, they added a few refinements to it. They applied it to somewhat smaller gas stations than the federal standard, and they also added this no topping off provision. And as it turns out, when you top off a vehicle, there's often spills involved, and the spills turn out to be one of the most significant sources of benzene exposure around gasoline stations. So it's something that's pretty straightforward to do and gets a lot of benefit.
So just to follow up, are you working on that through rule?
That rule has already been adopted.
Okay.
It hasn't gone into effect yet.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Can I just play that out?
Yeah, sure. Follow up.
So I mean, I go to the station now, and they'll ask me if I want it to be topped off, and they won't be able to do that. But let's say with these systems, sometimes they get, I'm going to call it some type of airlock or something within the time they're filling it up, and it just shuts off. Are they going to tell me, sorry, we can't put any more gas in? And I'm saying, wait a second, you just put 2 gallons in, and I know I need 10 more. I mean, how is that going to work, or is it, you know, what's the regulation and enforcement for that?
Madam Chair, Senator Przanski, that will not prevent them from being able to add more gasoline when there was a system malfunction or a vapor lock that prevented it from filling up. This is a matter of when the tank has reached essentially full and they're just trying to get it to a rounded off number or just add just a little bit more, and that's when the spills occur. So we'll have guidance materials, technical assistance, fact sheets, and things like that will provide to the gas stations and let them know how to handle that type of situation.
So in other words, we're probably going to be needing a lot of pennies or getting a lot of pennies back.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. Thank you, Andy, and we will have you back here next week on Thursday the 29th because we have your bills up. That'll be posted
great.
Soon.
Thank you.
And with that, I will close the informational hearing of DEQ. Close the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee, and we'll see you next Tuesday.